Hey, everybody. I'm David Rice. I'm the chief editor at Dentistry IQ. And with, as always.
Hey, everyone. Pam Maragliano-Muniz. David, oh my gosh. I'm like dying this week. This is going to be a good one.
It is. We have, I'm going to say, a couple extraordinary gentlemen, kind of also giants in our profession, and two of the strongest people I know. Vulnerability to me is one of the most beautiful and strong qualities a human could have. So I'm so grateful for today. Pam, you want to take us in?
Absolutely. So I am thrilled and honored and happy and delighted and all the things to introduce our two guests today, Dr. Alan Mead, who I think many of you know through podcasts, and Gary Cady, who you probably know because we record videos every month together. And so we're on Instagram all the time, and we're on DE Solutions Lab every month. So it's sort of like the mixing of all my world. So it's fantastic. Thank you for joining us, to both of you.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So today's topic, we're talking about kind of overcoming challenges. And specifically, we're going to be talking today about sobriety. A lot of dentists struggle with it. It's probably one of the biggest epidemics among dentists. And I'm not sure why that's the case, but I mean, I guess I have plenty of ideas why. But both of you have been able to kind of overcome it. And I was hoping that maybe we'll start with Alan. So Alan is a dentist still practicing. Gary is a practice coach and, you know, and is a facilitator with dentists. So it's sort of different perspectives on which you guys have struggled. So Alan, I'd like to start with you because I think a lot of us as dentists will be able to kind of, you know, we'll be picking up what you're putting down. So would you share kind of some highlights of your story?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you were saying you're not sure why addiction and alcoholism is runs rampant in dentistry, and I am sure. I know exactly why. Mm-hmm. The culture is soaking in alcohol, basically. I mean, actually alcohol wasn't really my problem. Alcohol was where I started, but I remember I didn't drink that much in college. When I turned 21, I was a senior in college, and I drank probably like. Maybe not even a regular college student. I drank, I was 21. I started to catch up from not drinking, but I remember being the night before our white coat ceremony at the University of Minnesota in 1993. And they didn't call it a white coat ceremony then, but I think that's what it was. I was at the bar with a bunch of my new friends. I remember I lived at the Psi Omega house, and I've told the story 1,000 times on the podcast, but like they had a pop machine. And they had a kegerator, which was basically a refrigerator with a keg of beer in it. It was 50 cents for pops, but the keg was free. So like that might be one of the best analogies of like just the culture of dental school and dentistry in general, I think. And mind you, as I've gotten older, as I've gotten like longer in my sobriety, I tend to be more irritated at that culture than I used to be. I used to just assume that it was part of the thing. But the problem is that if we just assume it's part of the thing, then we normalize some stuff. And I suspect Gary has something to say about this too. But so the reality is that I started drinking in dental school, and I probably drank a little bit like an alcoholic when I was in dental school. The great news for me is I rarely had to drive anywhere because everything was on campus. I lived close enough to the school that I walked. So some of the consequences of heavy drinking when I was in dental school were probably born from the fact that I didn't drive very much. I mostly walked and stuff. So, and I was the guy that was always happy to go out to the bar on Tuesday nights or whatever. And I would always drag a friend and that sort of thing. But so alcohol was a big part of dental school. I don't know that I was an alcoholic at that point, but when I came home from dental school, after I graduated, I came home to the town I grew up in, the town I live in now, started practicing with my dad. And I realized there's kind of a big hole in my life. Like I didn't realize drinking was a coping mechanism for me in dental school that I didn't realize it was a coping mechanism, but it was. So I got back to the real world, and the coping mechanism of dragging your friends out to the bar didn't really work. Like I didn't have that. It was a little harder to do that as a young dentist in town, that sort of thing. It's not that I didn't drink. I just didn't, I wasn't very social with the stuff, but they started giving out samples called Vicoprofen back in probably it was 98 or something like that, 97, 98. They give it out. You guys remember the Vicoprofen samples? That
I do.
I mean, like they, I've joked about it before. It was like, it was marketed specifically at dentists because it had, it was hydrocodone mixed with ibuprofen. And they give free samples to dentists to give to patients. Well, I started my drug, you know, that's kind of how I started. That said, there were always kind of, you know, we had diazepam available at the office, nitrous oxide. So I started experimenting, and it did not take me long to decide this needed to be part of my life because I'd made the alcohol part of my life and it was more socially acceptable and normal. But I had found that as a coping mechanism that worked really well for me. So then I basically, about 1998, I kind of kicked off four solid years of active addiction that just got worse and worse from there. So, and then in, actually one of my best friends, an oral surgeon in town, he's still an oral surgeon in town, helped put together an intervention for me in 2002, January 2002. And my family came together and they intervened on me. They did an intervention. I always say that like the TV show interventions are much better television than my intervention was because I was always like, every once in a while, Gary probably knows this story. Every once in a while, you'd like stick your head up and look around. You'd have this moment of clarity going, what am I doing to myself? What is going on? So like there was a little part of me in the back of my head that knew how messed up everything I was doing was. And I wished I could stop, but I didn't know how. And well, so when someone came and basically, as my brother-in-law likes to say, he starskied and hutched my car so I couldn't run away when they came to my office after lunch. Like my team, who knew what was going on, the intervention team said, don't go back to work after lunch. We're coming to get him after lunch. And so, yeah, it was so when faced and I had to admit what I was doing, I was ready. That's pretty rare. Pretty rare. And actually they took me into deep, like they drove me over to Grand Rapids, 2-hour drive. I was in detox right off. And that's the last time I ever used. Like I've never gone back out since then. So my story is everyone's story is a little different, but everyone's story is a lot the same. And so that was kind of what happened with me. And so that was 22 years ago. And I mean, I've been through a lot of, you know, I was on a contract to make sure I was safe with my patients. I never got in trouble with my license or anything like that, but I followed a pretty tight, in Michigan, it's called the Health Professionals Recovery Program, and they monitor you and, you know, random drug tests, and you do therapy and you do meetings. And you do, I mean, it was all the stuff was great because it fit right in with someone who was newly in recovery who wanted to get better. And so it worked out really well for me. That is a very short version of my story. But so but dental school is kind of where it started for me, realistically. Like I needed a coping mechanism because dental school, college was easy. Dental school was a nightmare for me. It was really hard for me. And I didn't manage myself very well. So I found alcohol as a coping mechanism. And that kind of kicked off kicked it off for me in dental school. So I do understand why dentists have a problem with this because that's kind of how dental school and dentistry was. So that's sort of where it came from.
I think you're right, actually, now that you mention it. It's funny. It's like every time there's an exam block or any time you're kind of done with a semester or something like that, it was like the free pass to now go and drink as much as you can, as often as you can, whenever you want.
Gross anatomy, the very last gross anatomy exam you had, I remember there were a lot of people that were in pretty, they were in trouble that night. that night we went a little crazy because we were done with one of the, you know, the grind classes, that sort of thing. Stuff like that, landmarks like that were always marked with alcohol in dental school.
And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't really the most mature human coming into dental school.
Yeah.
And I think that like some of those evenings became like badges of honor. Like we are just going to totally let loose. And then you told all your war stories and it's what bonded you to your classmates. And yeah, if we sit here and think about like how unhealthy that really is. And to your point, Alan, if that's the culture that we live by every exam block, and you know, there's more exam blocks today for students today and how frequent that becomes and how the norm that becomes, it's a slippery slope.
I agree.
So yeah. Gary, how about you?
My sobriety date is May 1st, 2008. So I've been doing this for 15 years straight. And, It was the worst and best thing I've ever done. And I'll say it was the worst because when you're grappling with am I not, that is living hell in my experience. I'll rewind all the way back to coming out of the womb. I think I was destined to be an alcoholic because I was a self-medicator because of two things. I never felt I belonged anywhere, and I was completely uncomfortable in my skin. And all I did was try to, figure out ways to numb myself to get inside of this. Like I was extreme sports and like adrenaline. I was a workaholic because I didn't want it. You know, I was like, I wouldn't drink till 5 p.m. because then I'd be declared an alcoholic if I drank before 5 p.m. So that these are the belief systems that I was doing to justify my world, right? So I'm sitting there, can't drink before 5. So I was a workaholic from the minute I woke up till 5 p.m. And then I cracked either a beer or wine was my drink of choice. And, I didn't want to live and I didn't want to die, right? But there was like, I only had one friend and it was alcohol. Like that was it, the rest people around me coexisted, but there was one thing that was never going to leave me. And I started drinking on their, my favorite drinks, Tanqueray, Boone's Farm back in the day, Night Train, all the cheap stuff. I used to go in at 16 because I looked older than everybody. I was tall and I was looked older. So I was able to get drinks for everybody. And I just remember like, I never had these, like I had some close calls, but I never had anything that was going to pummel me into stopping. So I always hovered above the alcohol Mendoza line, if you will, like where I would be like successful, but I would be holding it all together. So like what people were looking at and on stage in my early career was a guy who was trying to be accepted in the world. Right. Just love me. You know, I've learned now that there's two places to be in life, being in love or a call for love. I was a perpetual call for love. And all I wanted was people to like me. And so that's how I got on the stage a lot. And, I would spew information, but it wasn't until I got sober. And it's funny, getting sober is my wife came to me. So when you pile up circumstances, so the year was 2006-07, economy tanking. My son was diagnosed with autism, and I'm workaholism. So I got workaholism, autism, and alcoholism, and I didn't know where to turn. So usually what happens is like people break out in handcuffs at this point, or they get into an accident. Mine was, I had to give this inspirational speech to my team at the end of the year. And I decided to get wasted. And I said, this was the worst year. I just like hammered this negative speech, right? And my wife's under the table with her nails, twisting my quad. And she stood over me the next morning with her arms crossed and said, I'm never going to do that again. You don't have to quit drinking, but you can't stay here. We're moving back to New York. We were living in Arizona at the time. She moved back to Arizona. She said, if you're going to be drinking, don't come, because I need to get this kid healthy. I'm not going to get two boys healthy. You got to take care of yourself. And, I went to a meeting. I learned what I had to do. And then I drank it 90 days. Cause like, I figured if I could stop for 90 days, I'm good. Right. Meanwhile, what happens is I was a spiritually bankrupt soul. I had, on the outside, it looked like I had it all handled and I had nothing. And I share the story because while I'm not a dentist, I have the heart of a dentist, and I want to zoom out wider. Just yesterday, my feed, a dental assistant lost her license, I guess because she was an EFTA, because she was drunk at work. This is a industry-wide problem, not just for the men and women that have a dental license. This is, there's a lot of suicide that's going on, and we took on a suicide prevention. There's a real problem in dentistry, in my opinion. And I'm going to say this for the first time publicly, sort of like my friend Bob Costas, who came out, he was calling NFL football games, and he came out against, all the concussions that were happening and got really straight about stuff. So I might never see an ADA stage again, and I'm okay with it. And I'm going to come clean right now. And I need to say this for the first time. The ADA is will not say that you're not allowed to say the word suicide anywhere near the ADA. And that to me is a problem because that says that there's a stigma attached to it. And that's not okay with me. We have a problem. And it's not until this is what I learned by getting sober. It's awareness, acceptance, and action. First, you have to become aware and acknowledge what's there. Then get into acceptance about it. I am an alcoholic and declare that. And then get into action to heal because there's pain underneath every addict. There's pain. There's some kind of pain that's trying to be numbed. And so we took action on that. We went after and tried to support this. We created a suicide prevention program and it's really tied to alcoholics, and addictions directly. And I studied, while I'm not a dentist, I studied the personalities of dentists and team members. 80% of dentists are humanist methodicals. The pain that gets created by having to have all the answers and do everything right perfectly in a micron and no room to make a mistake. Also, the other thing I've noticed is the infliction of pain. Now, this was never stated by any dentist, but in all my research with dentists, delivering pain, there's a connection to pain. And there's this ecosystem of pain that gets invented. And I think that has something to do with it too. We eliminate frustrations for dentists. That's what I do at my core. That's what I've done my whole career because that's what I was trying to do, eliminate frustrations and pain. And the thing I've noticed is when dentists and dental team members are free of the reoccurring frustrations and the suffering of dentistry, the one thing they always say to me after is, I wish I would have done this years ago. I can now practice forever. And to me, that is the best currency that I could ever have. And that all came from putting the oxygen mask on myself first, addressing my own pain, knowing how to get to the other side of it. And then now how I stay sober is I turned my entire company into a service organization to help dentists, dental team members, and anybody in our great industry. Because, you go to a dental show, it's like a big flow of alcohol. It's like Alan said, dripping with alcohol. And everybody runs to it because there's so much pain associated to it. I want to give people hope who don't have it, who's listening. The other side of this is pure peace and bliss. It really is. It doesn't mean you don't have problems, but when you do the work that it takes to get to the other side of pain, you can't have pleasure without pain. I never understood that. I was always seeking pleasure. You cannot have one side of the game always seeking pleasure. You have to go through all of the emotions to feel all the emotions. And so I just want to give hope to anybody that might be on the fence, please, you reach out, ask for help. If we learned anything through the pandemic, asking for help is a strength, not a weakness. So that's some, hopefully I gave you a little backdrop of like my relationship to the industry and alcohol.
So I have a few questions. Thank you both for sharing that. But I think that many dentists are pretty functional. As you know, I would say that, you get through your day, kind of like what you described, Gary, you get through your day and then at the end of the day, you'll crack open a beer, whatever. You mentioned awareness. Would you say that, from a professional perspective, that maybe the dentist or the person who has the problem is the last one to know? Do you think that the team identifies it, your family might see it, your friends might kind of identify it, but you think you're pretty okay? Or do you think that if you dig deep, you realize that you have a problem? Like, how do you become aware? Because I think that there's people who might not even realize that they're suffering the way that they are.
Yeah, I started a group of dentists and they meet like twice a week and have meditation Fridays. And this is a topic that has come up actually. And people become self-aware. They just don't know how living without it could ever be. And you get stuck in this like rock and a hard place. So I knew I had a problem 10 years before I had a problem, right? But I was in denial about it. I was minimizing it because you, as an alcoholic and an addict, you can't imagine life without it. You realize that it doesn't do what you want it to do anymore, but I could not imagine living without it. So the day when my wife made that call, said, you don't have to quit drinking and can't stay here. I looked at a mountain on a lifetime going, how the hell am I going to ever do this? So that's where the rock and hard place get, that's where people get stuck. So in my experience, Alan, you might, I'm interested in hearing what your take is on this, but you know, in my experience is there's self-awareness, but there's like a denial about having to deal with it. And one thing we do know, dentists are methodicals. 80% of dentists are methodical humanists in the personality type. Avoidance and acquiescing is the root when you're confronted with a very high level of confrontation. And this is a very high level of confrontation.
Yeah, I was for a long time, I was on a committee in the Michigan Dental Association that helped dentists and team members that had trouble with drugs and alcohol. I think Gary's right. I think most dentists know that they have a problem. Most dentists in this situation, team members probably same. I think they probably know that there's a problem. Like I said, everyone seems to have like a moment of clarity every once in a while. But the reality is Gary's point about the idea of living without it is too overwhelming to even handle. So, you know, you kind of bury it. Now, I'll tell you an interesting thing. Alcohol is so ingrained in our culture that it would be easier for someone to not think they have a problem with alcohol. I've always said this. It's really funny. I had the advantage of drugs really being my problem. It's no one would look at the way I was using if I had ever admitted what I was doing. No one would have ever said, no, that's okay. Now what you're doing is fine. Like that's normal. People do that. I was taking handfuls of pills during the middle of the day. It's just not normal. And so I had to keep everything kind of under wraps. I didn't use with anyone else. So alcohol is a problem because our culture is so used to people drinking in celebration. And so, you know, if you met a friend for dinner after work, of course you're going to have a couple drinks, you know, that's I will say that the self-awareness with straight alcohol is probably harder. I never had to really deal with that myself, but because it's, Gary had said something earlier, like you had to face the fact that, you know, am I really an alcoholic? So I got to tell you, like, especially once I got into treatment, I never once was like, am I really an addict? Because like all you had to do was look at what I was doing and it was nuts. It was crazy. But if it had been alcohol, I think it would have been a lot harder. I think I said, well, I mean, in dental school, I drank like everyone else drank, right? And so was everyone else an alcoholic? No, I guess. I don't know. I'm kind of glad that I didn't have to justify. Like, it would be easier to justify what I was doing if it were something that was culturally normative. And that's one of the problems with dentistry and alcohol in the culture. It's really normalized. So it would be a little hard to get past that. So in any case, did I know I had a problem? Yes. I tried to stop a million different ways, but I never really could. I tried to do it the way that a dentist would do it. Like I would buy a bottle of pills and I would get those little coin envelopes and I would like divide it up because I was going to wean myself off of it. I would do systematic stuff like that. And of course, it never worked. Nothing like that ever worked. It was because I wasn't honest with anyone about it. Like I had never been, no one knew what I was doing in my brain. No one knew what I was doing. My team had a pretty good idea what I was doing. This friend figured it out. But I wasn't open about it. Like I let my family believe I was narcoleptic. I let them believe anything that would let me keep using. So that was kind of how it worked, you know, and I knew I had a problem, but I also was, I didn't think there was any way to face it. Like life without it, as Gary said, was just, I couldn't even imagine it. I couldn't imagine how that could work.
Yeah.
All right. So at what point would you say being an addict becomes an issue?
That's a pretty easy one. I like Narcotics Anonymous's take on this is basically any time that you're using becomes a problem for you or others. I mean, and so what does that mean? A DUI, that's probably a problem. Like missing work, that's a problem. There's like, the story is, I don't know that it has to be the same level in everyone's life, but I mean, even how they diagnose it is kind of how much of a problem it causes in your life. I mean, like how many marriages have broken up because of drinking or drugs? How many, like, So when is addiction a problem? Diagnosis of addiction is not my business. I have ideas in individual cases, but the other thing is like, you know, like Gary's probably heard this before too, you know, try it for 30 days. If you don't like it, we'll refund your misery. You know, it's like one of these things where, and the other thing is, if you've ever thought to yourself, man, am I drinking too much? Mm-hmm. If you get to a point where you are questioning whether you are drinking too much, you're probably drinking too much. Regular people that don't have a problem with alcohol never think to themselves, am I drinking too much? Am I right, Gary? Did I miss something there? Or is that real?
No, you're cracking me up. I'm really enjoying listening to you. You know, it's like, it's the point of where your life becomes unmanageable, mm-hmm. you know, but the problem with that one is Dennis really liked to suffer. You know, I always say pain is necessary and suffering is optional. If you stay in the pain, it's optional. But like what happens is dentists are paying themselves last, dealing with BS teams, dealing with BS, all this stuff. Yeah. The threshold for pain in dentists is so friggin' high. I'm trying to lower the score on this, Alan. And the threshold for pain is so ridiculously high. And my favorite thing I open up often is make the unacceptable unacceptable. If something is unacceptable for you, how much money you're making, how much weight you're carrying, how much, you know, your social life, your mental life, your all those things, if that's not working for you, I would look underneath. And I love what Alan said. Like my wife, we call her a normie. She's not questioning whether she's drinking too much. She mm-hmm. knows she'll drink a glass of wine. She can stop. Like we were out, she still drinks. We were out and I'm buying like $40 glasses of wine. You know, I'm not cheap, but when I'm not drinking them and you leave half, you know, I got a problem with that. My wife has no problem going, you know, I'm just done drinking this glass of wine. I'm great. Like I used to drink her wine when we would leave, you know, dinner, because it's like no glass left behind when you're an alcoholic, you know? So the people that have this challenge, if you're questioning it, that's a good start to start looking. And then what I would look at is your life working or not? Because if it's unmanageable, the last place an alcoholic looks for where the source of the problem is alcohol. And it's usually, in my experience, when I work, because I work with a lot of dentists who want to develop their practice, but they really want to develop their life. They come to us because they want to have a different kind of life than the suffering that they're in. And I'm not just talking business. They know that I've been out publicly about, you know, addictions. So a lot of people that come to us are suffering already and they just want to get it fixed. And it's like, boom, boom, boom. They start getting to work and their life, by the way, at my 90th day, for those people that are dealing with dollars, my business when I was drinking went down. When I stopped drinking for those 90 days, it went completely up. I wrote a book called Raise Your Healthy Deserve Level in my third year of sobriety. And what I learned was in life and in business, you don't get what you deserve. You get what you think you deserve. If you have low self-esteem and unworthiness, no matter what you do, you're never going to be able to have the time off you want, the money you want, because you think you're unworthy and undeserving, and you inflict self-inflicted pain on yourself, and you don't allow yourself to have joy when you're breaking integrity breaches throughout your day, which was mine. Was I said I wasn't going to drink at 5 p.m. and at 5 p.m. I'm drinking again. Integrity breach stops all the ability to receive and have love, joy, connection, peace, all the things that we all strive for. So that's where to look.
Thank you everyone for watching or listening to the show this week. And thanks to our guests and sponsors on this episode.
Please check out our social media at Dr. Pamela_Maragliano and at Dental Economics Official.
Or you can check me out at Ignite DDS or at Dr. David Rice.
And go to dentaleconomics.com to receive dental economics. You can choose to receive DE in print or digitally. And you can also get the details of our Principles of Practice Management Conference on our website.
If you have topics or guests or anything you'd like to talk about on the show, send us an email to dentistryunmaskedpodcast@gmail.com and we will do our very best to make it happen. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.